Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Video game lore can be, well, just awful. The problem is, video game creators are prone to making two erroneous assumptions about what constitutes a deep narrative. The first is that volume equals depth. In the classic tradition of epic science fiction and fantasy literature, studios will craft thousands of pages of backstory, often involving many hundreds of characters and vast intergalactic wars. Sometimes it seems as though, early in a narrative meeting, one writer will say to another, "Okay, let's set this in the middle of a war that's been running for 100 years. Then their colleague replies, "No, wait, how about 1,000 years? And then everyone agrees this is exponentially deeper. It isn't. It's just an extra knot on the end of a conflict that, without context, pathos, or human tragedy, is ultimately meaningless." Those were the words of Keith Stewart in a piece titled, "Why is Video Game Lore So Awful?" I'm Danielle Riendo, and this is Waypoint Radio, episode 186. Joining me today are Natalie Watson.
Hi, hi.
Rob Zachney.
Hello, hello.
And special guest, Kato.
Hey.
Special guest today, of course, Kato,
yep.
Because we're talking about lore, and today is a very special day. It's September 14th,
yep.
And today there is a new raid in Destiny 2.
Very excited.
I think you're very excited, and also, since Destiny has always been a very lore-heavy game, and there's this new content, and we all want to talk about lore, that would be a good little place for us to hang our little narrative hats on today. So, Kato, why don't you get us started a little bit on, first of all, this new raid and how Destiny sort of uses raids now, it seems, to sort of add lore to its grand and deep and rich universe.
Yeah, so since the beginning, actually, since Destiny 1, raids were always they weren't tied to any of the main narratives, usually. There was one big exception to that, which is a standout, which was the Taken King, which, if you don't know, was like the second DLC, the second year of DLC for Destiny that, like, everyone said, like, made the game so much better. It was like the high point of Destiny 1. And that raid did lead directly from, like, the end of the campaign into the story that the raid told. But other than that, like, most of the raids are kind of these separate siloed off things that add these bits of world building and stuff. Also, like, a lot of the lore in Destiny was delivered, at least in the first game, through the Grimoire system, which was a bunch of digital cards that you could only access on a website outside of the game, which was not great. I personally did enjoy reading them, like, when I was not playing the game. Like, I would read up as I was, like, on the subway or whatever. But it sucked that you would see this little pop-up and be like, "There's new lore. Go to Bungie.net and log in with your PSN account and make a new Bungie account in order to read this lore that you supposedly unlocked in the game." And so a lot of people didn't actually engage with that. And what's really interesting to me now is that this current expansion that just came out for Destiny 2 has circled back around on a lot of lore in Destiny 1 that I feel like not a lot of people saw. Personally, like, the thing that's interesting to me is wondering, like, whether or not anyone who hasn't seen that lore is going to get any sort of impact out of the campaign. It's kind of weird to see all these, like, threads that I've been reading about, and, like, usually, like, in every other expansion and release for Destiny since the beginning, they've never brought the lore into the game proper. It's always been like, here's some stuff that happened way long ago, or here's some stuff that, like, is, like, way out in the margins and, like, not really connected.
Well, and the lore was always, like, really impressionistic. This is the other thing.
Yeah.
Is the Grimoire lore was tonally really different from Destiny.
Absolutely.
I always thought. Like, so I started playing Destiny 2 again, which, boy, coming back to that after a year off sure is disorienting.
Right.
Like, I open up the game director, and I'm like, what is happening? And then the game wouldn't let me play the expansion. It's like, I'm sorry, sir, you're a little underleveled for,
wow,
for this expansion.
No.
Like, I felt like I was applying for a fucking apartment.
Yeah. Credit's not good enough, Rob.
Too real.
Do your mom and dad have accounts with Destiny that we can verify? Like, could they backstop you on that? Yeah. Could you run this with your parents? No. But the thing that I'm not sure is compatible with sort of the direction that lore is going in Destiny, and I'm curious what you think of this, Kato, is like, so it does sort of seem like they're trying to at least merge a little bit the fiction of the game as you play it, and then the backstory, the lore and world building that used to exist in the Grimoire, and they're trying to unite those a little bit. The problem is, in the process of doing that, they don't seem to be changing the tone of Destiny. It's more like everything that was cool and ambiguous in the Grimoire, you're getting the just-the-facts version of that. So it becomes like,
right,
all the tone is sort of bleached out of it, and it goes into Destiny voice, which is all very triumphalist and straightforward and sassy. You know, we're just a bunch of cool wizards. You know, boy, we sure did destroy those Kells, didn't we? Up top. And, like, you're not going to get the equivalent of this one card I've been thinking a lot about lately. This character, Varix, who I think is a turncoat member of, like, the House of Wolves?
Well, he was part of the House of Judgment, which was his own house, but he's the last surviving member. And they associated with themselves with non-fallen, which was the weird thing about them.
But there's this card where he is, like, basically, he's become a collaborator with the enemy of his people. And he's, like, running a prison / fight club, like, death arena.
It's a gladiatorial, arena for the Woken. And it's not, and there's fallen in there. There are fallen, they're people of his,
But there's this card where he's sort of thinking about, like, he's ushering them to the gladiatorial arena for another day of slaughter. And he's like, is this... He it's just him sort of going through his inner monologue, like, is he a traitor? How does he feel about this? And the card leaves that unresolved. I'm not sure that's compatible with the way Destiny tells its story, that kind of ambiguity, ambivalence.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't... At least for the first half of this new campaign, it really, the tone and that doesn't line up, right? It's only actually like near the very end of what is the campaign, and more again they like seeded this in like surrounding the raid and like in the end game, but like at the end of the campaign, the tone shifts and it becomes, It kind of tries to align itself more with the tone of the lore because Cade is gone, right? So you don't have that. He was like the cheesiest character in Destiny always. He was the one always cracking jokes. And I feel like it's this almost meta narrative of like, we're killing off our comedic relief. Like, we're serious now. Like, we know that y'all liked the Grimoire. Here's that shit, like, in the game. Yeah, normally up until now, like, that hasn't been the case. Every narrative in Destiny has been like, let's go kill all the aliens. You don't really care why, right? Like, it's fine. And then all the backstories, like, filling in like what any of these NPCs are actually thinking, like things that you barely get in any sort of in cutscenes or anything like that. Like, it was two separate worlds, and I'm interested to see where they go forward with this, because their plan right now, their content plan, is to not release any more story content. There won't be any more missions in the next three DLCs. It's just going to be activities, new raids. And, like, it feels like they're just going to be leaning more and more on the lore, which they, to be fair, they put back into the game. There's a Grimoire-like system in Destiny 2 now. but you can read it in the game and also offline.
Where does it live? I'm curious, because I was going through Destiny yesterday, and like I saw the Triumph system and all that stuff, but none of mine was filled in yet. I'm curious, like, so is that the new Grimoire?
Yeah, it's in the Triumphs. So Triumphs in general is just like small little like in-game achievements or whatever, and one of them is lore, and you get that fed to you in a couple different ways. One of them is there's collectibles that you pick them up and you get a new lore card, and the other way is just like by going through the campaign you'll get like extra lore, and like that's basically that lore that you get during the campaign for finishing certain campaign missions is kind of that old style of Destiny lore where you're getting a lot of like side stories and like introspection that isn't in the main campaign. And then as you reach the end game, it's just like, okay, now that we're done with that, you're not getting any more of this Destiny narrative story. You're just getting lore and like the mechanics of like the end game zone is all around just finding that lore in the world. And it's also like, it's like set up with a lot of Destiny 1 lore that people don't know probably, which is.
It's great to history.
It's great to me, like, because I know, like, I really, like, there's this one turn of phrase that if you were really into Destiny 1 lore, you would recognize. It's, blank mine. So if you're reading a lore card, it would say, oh, reader mine. Or if you're wearing a piece of armor, it would say, oh, bearer mine. And that is, there's these dragons, these, like, mythical, like, ancient dragons that apparently were all killed. They were all killed off, like... They would grant wishes, but it was like a monkey paw situation. It was never
Homer,
what you
right on my back.
Yeah, and these dragons were like, it was a really cool piece of lore that was like, you never expected them to touch it in the main game. It was like, it's just like neat bits of flavor on pieces of armor and in the grimoire, and like everything in. The campaign, and I don't know about the raid yet, but everything's been pointing to, like, actually, we're going to meet one of these dragons in the game. And as a longtime player of Destiny, that's, like, very exciting. Like, okay, cool, we'll see what they actually look like, or, like, whether or not, like, I'm interested in what they're going to do with that interaction, but I don't trust them to pull it off well. Because what was interesting about those dragons in the lore is that they're, like, these weird tricksters that, like, you know, are... luring people into like weird deals with them, but I mean, if you're listening to this, I'm probably in the raid right now and like learning about whether or not they like pull this off, because raids have historically been very puzzle heavy. So I could see a way where like one of these they're called Ahamkara being the boss can fit into the mechanics of like having a lot of puzzles in like a thing, but like. It's gonna be a difficult. I don't know that that's where they're going, or if that's gonna be how they pull that off. Yeah.
One of the biggest questions. Thank you, Kato, for making a lot of this make sense to me. Because I, honestly, what I know about Destiny comes from, you know, playing very little of the first game, and then playing, you know, the first couple hours of the second game, but. Hearing things from people about the Grimoire and that there are amazing side stories and cool bits and pieces all kind of all over the place, but somebody who doesn't play Destiny, I'm just sort of like, is this like a Metal Gear Solid situation where you need to be all in or none of it makes sense? You know,
it kind of is. Well, the thing is that what Bungie really wants to do is to have its cake and eat it too, right? Like they want the people who are going to be really fucking invested to read all the lore and be invested, but they also are trying to keep the campaign separate enough that if somebody picks it up, like it's not going to matter to them. Like it'll be a fun whatever adventure through the like. Cosmos.
It's such a weird fucking thing because like Destiny on some level is always going to be the game that was in those initial ads, those full motion video ads,
right?
With like actor where it's like hey bros,
what's
what
up,
what are we doing today? We're just hanging out on the moon, like AC/DC.
No, we're going to Venus.
Play.
Yeah, no, yeah. Fucking, they got and, Led Zeppelin for the second one. Yeah.
Yeah, and like I mean it's that like to a degree it's always going to be a game where as you're playing it, you half expect a major character to show up with like a cube of natty ice or something like that. and be like, hey guys, I brought party supplies. Aww. And It's always going to be that game to an extent, but then it's also like, it's that game, but also like in the backdrop, it's like, ooh, what's this like beautiful, mysterious, mournful, like dreamscape that I'm inhabiting? And then in the lore, it's trying to do that thing where it's like, actually, there's some hard sci-fi going on in here and some like, and we're also trying our hand at like poetry and microfiction.
Yeah.
I think if you like, don't worry, like, this is between us. Like, don't tell the bros over there.
Yeah, everything's going to be okay.
And it's such a weird thing to me. And I can't work out if it's brilliant or just ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, it feels a little bit just like part of AAA game development, right? Like, at a certain point, you're going to lose a certain amount of, like, the demographic if you go too serious into the lore or something. But that's why this last expansion is interesting to me, because they are doing that now. Like, they're mm-hmm. starting to go deep into the lore. They're starting to just be like, all right, like, all of that, like, partying's out of the way. Now let's get serious. We're talking about mythical wish dragons that can change, you know, make dimensions of their own. And, like, we're in it now.
But it seems like mitigated enough that you aren't like, it's like you have to seek it. Like, you have to pay. So if the brosif, right. Like, I don't know, brosifs, I don't know, maybe not all brosifs, I don't know, like lore or whatever. But anyway, if the typical player who doesn't care about lore, whatever they may be colloquially named,
Brors.
Like, does bro?
Sorry.
It seems like that can be missed, or at least like not paid attention to in a way that like feels like, oh, I should be paying attention to this for like significance or for like finesse of playing the game.
Right. It's definitely like. That's why it's weird to it's why I'm interested in seeing what's next, because this ends on such a lore heavy and like on a, just such a like tonal shift for the series mm-hmm. that so part of the thing with Destiny 2 was that there was a big like fan outlash on like a lot of the systems in the game at the beginning, and this expansion has been a lot of like correcting back to what the players, the community, quote unquote, really mostly just the Reddit, the subreddit, because they're the loudest, want in the game. And I think part of that is also like that tonal shift. And it seems like they've given up on that wider demographic because they know that at this point, maybe it's too late to pick up on like all of the bros at this point. It's like if the bros haven't gotten onto Destiny 2, they're not going to now. Cool. And so, like, we're free to, like, just dive in for the rest of the however long this game will last before Destiny 3 happens.
I have a theory that Destiny was a cleverly disguised bro otaku assembly line. Where it's, like, it came in and it was, like, yo, let's just fuck up some bugs with machine guns. Hell yeah. Cool. Fist bump. And then, like, AC/DC plays for a little while. And then, like, someone slides a card across you after a mission and is like, but what if those robots are dreamers like you? And, like, it's like, huh. Well, anyway, off to kill some more robots.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, like, you keep getting these little snippets. And eventually it's like, oh, wait, this is all connected. What if the Traveler's role in this universe is more ambiguous than initially I thought? And then slowly, it's like, sorry guys, can't go out tonight, gotta read the Grimoire Library.
And I love it.
So
I love
this
you got
point
your natty ice in your hand, you got your laptop open.
Yeah, but you're drinking it now out of like a pint glass
right,
or
you
something.
Pour it out.
You're sort of like, yeah.
That is like the first image.
Yeah. Then, like, now you're outside the frat house, like in the lawn chair, you know, sort of nursing the natty ice.
Yeah.
And being
just
like,
just enjoying it.
Just savoring, really.
Just taking your time with it.
Just drink deeply of that natty ice. And maybe even contemplating, like, maybe I should, you know, think about getting into Red Dog. But but at this point, we are now, like, far enough along into Destiny, and they've been sort of spoon-feeding people, this universe. And, like, Destiny is a very silly game. Like, if you play it for a long time, you're because we're people, because we like narratives and stories and puzzling out the mysteries and unexplained shit we see around us, I kind of wonder, like, at a certain point, all those people that Destiny brought in through the door of, like, hey, it's a good-looking game about space wizards rocking automatic weapons. All those people now, like, after a number of years of having this shit worked on them, are all like, yeah, but I wonder what is up with the Reef. And what is the relationship between the Awakened and the Fallen? Makes you think. And, like, maybe they don't need to do that anymore. And maybe that's why they killed Cade. Maybe Cade's, right, like, the guy who couldn't grow up. And everyone's like, sorry, man, like, we're here to study. And Cade died in a game of Flippy Cup.
The bro who couldn't make him think. R.I.P.
Wouldn't think.
R.I.P. Sorry, Cade. There's a lot of noise on our end. If you're hearing this, somebody is moving an elephant across the hall. So just
it's part of the lore. It's part of the lore of part Vice.
The deep lore.
Yeah. Hate it.
Of Lobby One.
Deep lore of Lobby One.
They're replacing the bear with an elephant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wouldn't be surprised, to be honest with you. So on the topic of sort of pleasing everybody or trying to, pleasing the bros and pleasing the otakus and everyone in between, I came across, when I was sort of looking up material for this particular episode, a really good talk from Jennifer Brandis Hepler. She was a writer at BioWare for a long time, was a writer on Dragon Age games for quite a while, and many, many other things. But yeah, and I'm sure we'll get to Dragon Age, don't worry.
At some point.
Yeah, exactly. But she did a talk at GDC a couple years ago called The Exposition Burden. Now, this was specifically about exposition, but it has a lot to do with what we're talking about. And it also explains, I think, a lot of why it's so difficult to do lore in AAA games, or just, honestly, probably in any team setting at all. So I'll just read a little bit from her talk here. So she's talking, and of course she's using slides, so I'll try to sort of illustrate this using my words here as much as I can. But she certainly had some cool visual aids to help this, so it won't be as good as when she did it, but I'll give it a shot. So she says, the purpose of game dialogue is to move the player forward. So why does so much game dialogue look like this? And then there's a slide that shows this sort of elderly RPG NPC-looking guy, you know, the old wizened man. And he goes, let me tell you about our people. Our histories begin in the Age of Stone. And then she says, end up with the player like this. And then, of course, there's a slide of a woman asleep on the keyboard. And then she goes into why this comes to be. Well, a lot of times it's because the dialogue starts out like this. We must defend against the evil empire. And then after a marketing meeting, it turns into, because they are trying to take over the world by turning dragons into dirty bombs. And then, when the lead designer needs to show off the deep, explorable world, you have to add this. The Empire hates us because back in the Age of Old, we once went to war over the dragon mines. And then when QA realizes the week before CERT that the whole area is empty and the level designers need to throw in some mobs, you also have to work this in. Oh, and while you're defeating the evil Empire, collect 20 orc skulls, okay? So, clearly, there's a whole world of collaboration that goes into making this all work. And of course, I think it always needs to be said that AAA game development, and really any game development on any level, is a hell of many, many needs and many, many different types of skill sets and many, many different types of motivations. And all of this needs to work together nicely. So I think that's something of an explanation for why lore can be a fucking mess and disaster in a lot of games. And one other question that I definitely want to pose to everyone here is not even a question, but a framing. So it sounds like Destiny is all of the above here. There's just so much of it, and it kind of hits on different notes in so many different ways, and now it's being implemented in so many different ways. But what is the difference between, and this is not an easy thing to answer, that's why I want it to be just sort of a framing for the rest of a conversation, but what is the difference between lore that actually just puts you to sleep, or makes you roll your eyes, or makes you sort of laugh at it, and not in the good way, and lore that actually really intrigues you and brings you into the world and makes you interested and excited to explore it more? And obviously there are examples on either side of this. But Natalie, I definitely wanted to talk to you a little bit about your experiences with Hollow Knight. And I think you had some things to say about Dragon Age as well. And I'm going to throw Bloodborne into the mix if you want.
Bloodborne is a good one. And I had not prepared for it, but it is definitely relevant. Yeah, I would say that Bloodborne took me, I mean, maybe it's the framing of how I started playing Bloodborne, where it really did feel like, okay, this playthrough is about beating this game, like in a, like a very like mechanical, physical sense. Like, I want to overcome the challenges that are presented at me, and I want to be good and get good and beat this game. So a lot of the time, which is unlike me, when I came across lore, I feel like I wasn't retaining it as much as I do in other games, only because I think I was just so focused on being like, okay, but I need fucking blood vials right now. I can't be reading some shit about some rags. Like, I need to go get more blood vials. So,
fair.
But the lore of Bloodborne did get really interesting right where we dropped off, which, you know, I don't know if we're going to pick that game back up again in-house. Unfortunately, my save is on Austin's account, so even if I wanted to keep playing, I could not. So I'd have to start from the beginning, which is a terrifying idea. I really don't want to fucking do that over again. No, I don't know if I would. I think I got really lucky sometimes.
Blood Reborn.
Yeah, I can't do it. But yeah, so I don't know. On my second playthrough, I think I would pay a lot more attention to the lore. But the lore is just so, it is referenced, but it's referenced in places where you really, really have to look, and you're not challenged much on your, or at least not directly, which is kind of hard for being, for coming at the game in the way that I was, like coming at it from like this, like, oh, I want to beat this game. I wasn't being challenged on my knowledge of the lore as much as I maybe wanted to, at least as directly as I would have liked for it to stay fresh in my head. But definitely there were moments where, like, something would happen and I'd be like, oh, so that's what's going on. So there was a little bit of that. But I wish that Bloodborne had what Dragon Age Inquisition has, which also Destiny seemed, I've never played Destiny, I've only played Gambit mode, hashtag joyous gamer forever, which is the Codex in Dragon Age. Yeah. And the Codex was something that, Dragon Age Inquisition was one of the first open world games that, like, lore heavy type games that I had really played and gotten into. And Dragon Age Inquisition is like one of my favorite games of all time. And I think that it has a lot to do with my ability to like be able to immediately go and reference something that was happening in the world and like cross-reference it with my codex. And what's interesting about the codex too, which I didn't realize until I was looking at the Wikia for Dragon Age, is that the codex is also filled out based on who you play as. Hmm. So if you play as a Dalish, like the Dalish are the elves of the of what's it called, Thedas. If you play as a Dalish elf, any sort of entries about elves in your codex will be written by other elves, whereas other wardens, if you play as a different race, it will be written by humans, which is like very interesting, especially because so much of elven culture in that game has been recovered and have to be reinterpreted on lost artifacts, or like artifacts that aren't like their current, their original function is not known, so it's like just kind of guesswork at what it could be, which I mean, if you play Dragon Age Inquisition, I won't spoil it, I don't know, it's been out for like 3 years or four years.
I think,
yeah,
actually.
4 years,
yeah, yeah.
But that is not almost, like a lot of the interpretations of you know, ancient Dalish elves is wrong. So that I think was like really crucial for me, because whenever I entered a space, whenever I encountered people, whenever I found, you know, a new animal that seemed kind of odd or whatever, I could immediately go in within the game into my codex and reference it, which was really cool. Contrast that with Hollow Knight, which doesn't have any sort of like journal or codex or, you know, scrapbook to keep all of your sort of lore bits in. I feel like Hollow Knight was the perfect amount of lore that like it was just so digestible in a way that if I missed something in the world, or if I wanted to piece things together, I didn't feel bad about going outside into like the internet to like read about lore stuff, because it wasn't like a lot of those things were so transient. Like there were conversations that would be lost you know, sometimes they were cut scenes that, you know, you can't go back to and things like that, but they weren't kept in, or there were a lot of them were like artifacts that you'd find that the shopkeeper would read, you know, I'll tell you a little bit about them. But I didn't feel as bad going outside of the game to understand the lore, because these objects were so transient in the sense that I couldn't really hold on to them for very long. And a lot of the time I don't want to go out of the game to read things about the game, because I feel like I'm getting sort of someone else's understanding of it, or like I'm reading someone else's writing and it's not the game's writing, it's not people in, like, I like to think about it as in the codex way, you know, people in this game's history, characters in this game's history are writing, are contributing to this world, to this lore building. I love that. I love the idea that there's contributions all contained within the world itself. But for Hollow Knight, I don't know. I don't know why. I guess.
Does it have something to do with like how it supports that theme? I've only played a little Hollow Knight, but it always seemed like a very sort of wistful and melancholy, and you know, you're saying the idea of sort of transience. Does it just kind of work with that theme well, or is it more, or is it maybe something entirely?
Yeah, I think it does, and I think there is, you know, something that. There is something to melancholia where, you know, some things just like float right by you while you're in that kind of state. And things that are significant, like things that are like important events or things that people are telling you just kind of float right by, and you don't really get to grab onto them because you're, I don't know, you're fucking sad. Like, I don't know. Like, you're really sad. But so I think it does work. And I think that they're like, everyone is so kind of disconnected from each other in Hollow Knight. Like, all of the sort of little sections and like different little communities in the game are very disconnected from each other, and there's not a lot of communication between them at all, because the only people that are going in between them are like adventurers who are like looking for, you know, the Hollow Knight, whatever, like the treasure is, or
dying
a lot. And then but there's no, unless you're traveling by foot, there's no way to traverse through the world, because the person you play as is the only one who has the ability to use the stagways, which are like kind of like the main mode of fast travel through the game, and the trams, which let you go past like a certain level, go across a certain like level of the world. So it makes sense that, you know, nobody's really writing, you know, nobody's collecting. You are the only one that gets the exposure to everything, so you're the only one that gets to collect this. And you're busy trying to save the world. You're not trying to write everything down. So I guess it does make sense, even though I would love for there to be like a journal or something in that game. It does make sense that, you know, this little man's, I don't know what to call him, but I love him so much.
Bunny, bunny bug.
Yeah, little bug. He is his, I don't want to spoil it. Okay, I'm not going to spoil it. but I will say that's not his main focus. You know, he's not here to, the only reason why he's exploring the world is to figure out how to fix it. Or get to the people that can help him fix it. And it's not about, you know, the communities and the like relationships you have along the way are all, a lot of them are completely like the relationships you develop are optional. So unless you're as the player looking for that, you can completely miss it. So it makes sense that the character that's not embedded in the game itself, that you are the sort of like lore keeper or whatever.
Rob, you got something there.
No, I'm thinking about, for me, whether there's the distinction worth getting into between, there's a few things there actually. Like one is, I was thinking this morning about the BioWare model, which is like a lot of their games literally do have, like you were saying, Natalie, that in-game resource. Like there's an encyclopedia approach within the game where it's like, okay, here is where important facts and information and context about the world are stored. Mass Effect did this, where you could like literally go into an exhaustive encyclopedia and have a narrator be like, the Mass Effect engine was invented and like that was how that game rolled.
Yeah, sorry, our race.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. But I was also thinking, like this morning, how little an impression most of that stuff made on me. I don't remember jack about the Mass Effect universe from that encyclopedia.
Nope.
What I remember
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Go ahead. That's my
What I do remember, though, is like, oh, that's right. The humans were the enemies of, like, the Turians at first, because that's when Ashley's, like, grandfather or father, like, disgraced himself by surrendering in that battle. Like, and it's like, oh, like, that, like, created, like, relatable stakes for the internal history of this universe. This was a thing that informed people's experience of the world moving forward. I don't remember a ton about, like, how did the whole Rachni, the Rex people, what is the name of that, that race?
Krogans.
Yes. Krogans. I was like, Kroger's, that's not right, that's a store. but I couldn't remember, like, the details of that, but what I do remember is Morden trying to explain to you, like trying to justify, he's like, no. The genophage isn't a genocide. Here's the elegance of the solution that we came up with. And it's like totally like mad scientist stuff in a lot of ways. And it's a gross analogy for a lot of real world things, which is why I don't think that is necessarily the most thought through plot line. But again, it is a thing that is carried for, like, that is an event, that is history that has informed and marked all the characters it touches, right? Like, Rex is an expression of this historical trauma that's been inflicted by these sort of paternalistic powers. Morden is basically a brilliant scientist who willingly became sort of a Mengele-like figure and is spending the rest of his life trying to figure out, like, what that means and whether he can be redeemed from that. And that is, like, all that stuff exists. It is informed by, like, the history as recorded in the lore. But the way it is portrayed in the game and the way I think it makes a successful impression is all of that stuff is utilized to get at things about the characters, to get at things about the conflict, the personal conflicts you're dealing with today. And I think that's a lot of lore, I think, gets tripped up into being like history and backstory for a universe, but like that's not how we experience the world.
Well, I was just gonna say, I think that, you know, thinking, I think if I hadn't written like two or three essays on Dragon Age Inquisition during my time at NYU.
Wow.
I wouldn't be able to recall a lot of what's in the codex because so much of what I went into was like that elf. What I was fascinated mm-hmm. by was that like that elf like reclamation of culture. But when I think about like the moments that like the moments that revealed those things, or the thing, the moments that stayed in my head about that, it is like the interactions between Solas and, you know, the Inquisitor.
Yeah.
And that is always what's gonna stick in my head. And I think you're so right, Rob, about like history is history, but history does inform who we, you know, who these characters come to be, and like what their you know burdens are, what their interpretations of the world may be, and that is so much more memorable, or like that sticks so much more in your head as a player, or at least for me, I think, and I guess for you too, Rob, than, you know, I don't remember one fucking sonnet from Dragon Age Inquisition. I'm sorry. There were a lot, and I don't remember a single one because why? But I appreciate it. But also, I don't know.
And that's part of why I really enjoy the way that the Destiny Grimoire was delivered, is that it was never that encyclopedic, like, this is what happened here, here, and here. It's like, these are these stories, like, and they're completely separated. Like, you can string them together if you want, but it's more like, this is a conversation between two people about, like, how Vex simulation might work. Like, we don't know. It's also, it's never like, this is, like, some sort of, like, encyclopedic truth that has been discovered in the world. It's always like, here's these stories from the past that informed the world that way. Like, I think lore delivered through that form of narrative rather than like the codex, like in like year whatever of, you know, in Mass Effect. I don't remember any of the codex stuff from Mass Effect. Like, I remember the story that happened in the actual game.
Yeah.
And similarly, I barely remember what happened in the actual game of Destiny, but I remember a lot of the grimoire, and like, it can tell you all about the sword logic and how the Hive resurrect themselves, because that those lore cards were really well written and really interesting, and not just like, here's this information. It's like, here's a story that you can glean information from.
It's kind of cool how it all seems to be like, all right, well, the way the human brain works is kind of piecemeal, right? Or we like things to be piecemeal in a lot of ways, and we enjoy, or at least a certain type of player. I don't want to generalize to like every single human being who plays a game, but for myself, and I think for many people, it's more enjoyable and more like pleasurable to kind of put the clues together and kind of make the little timeline in your head than it is necessarily to have it like, there it is, folks. Right. And not that, you know, having the encyclopedic thing is a bad thing. It might be nice to sort of have a reference to go back to, or, you know, the common thing of like, I haven't played this game in 2 years. I don't remember shit.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, right, right. A, B, and C. Okay, here we are. Here we go. That could be a helpful resource, but not, you know, necessarily the thing or the goal that you want to put together, basically. One game that does this really well. Sorry, Rob.
No, go for it.
I just want to shout this out super quick and then definitely go back to you. One game that does this so well is Life is Strange, and especially the Before the Storm game, which, again, I know there's complications around. Every time we talk about this game, we're always going to, you know, mention that there were some labor issues in that game, and want to be clear, not condoning that. But what I do want to shout out is the fact that the sort of diary in that game was incredible and funny and had, like, jokes and awesome other things that sort of you know, served as something of a plot summary or something of a, okay, events A, B, and C happen, these relationships are important. You know, it's a very story-based game about a teenage girl, and it was like flipping through her scrapbook or her diary, and there's stickers and there's drawings, and then there's her kind of going through the events of the game. There was one really memorable and adorable and I thought hilarious joke about you know, so it's Chloe, and she's like writing to Max, sort of the main character of the first game, and she writes about I think it was like the way she phrased it was like, I rubbed one out to Pris, as in the like sexy robot from Blade Runner, the other night. It's like the way she phrased it, and I don't want to like mangle it, but it was just a very funny like little weird joke that's very like, oh, she's so gay, and this is really funny, and, like, just cute and funny, and that was just a thing in the diary. You know, that wasn't like, oh, we made a big deal about this joke that we wanted to really deliver on in a cinematic or something. It's like, no, that's just, like, a really funny little bit of lore that tells you so much about this, like, nerdy girl who's kind of finding herself and, like, finding her sexuality, and, like, yeah, of course she did. Of course she thought Pris was hot, all right? Yeah, that's good. That's really, really good, right? So I think that game does that super, super well in that context of having, like, a diary or a, you know, the pause screen actually has a really awesome function that helps you understand the story and the characters. So, Rob, you totally had something there, and I interrupted, so.
No, I was just thinking about, there's another angle of, it is fun to put those pieces together.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of games that basically the entire game is trying to basically put together a chronology, assembling the history yourself. Like, two games that occurred to me that sort of do this to varying degrees of success, I would argue. System Shock 2 is basically entirely about assembling the order of events, like, in which things went wrong on this. But, like, every audio log has a time and date, like, stamped onto it.
I love that.
And, it is doing the, like, Bioshock radio play, but really it's also about, like, assembling in your head this picture of, like, who these people are and their arc through this crisis toward their eventual end. That's basically, like, what you do in System Shock 2. That is the story of System Shock 2. It is, you know, who sold out, who died a hero, who reclaimed or tried to reclaim their soul, and who threw in with the annelids. I think another game that does this, and I don't like this game as much, and I think it's because of this very reason, Everybody's Gone to the Rapture is another game that's literally just like, okay, we took a pretty straightforward story, we shuffled the deck of cards, and we scatter them around this village. Now go explore and be fascinated. And I'm not sure once you put the pieces together, even as you're doing it, it starts to feel a little bit contrived, I think, because I never found the story of the characters all that interesting. And so it was like kind of a disappointing treasure hunt for me, like a very slow disappointing treasure hunt where it's like, we tied your shoelaces together, now go assemble a picture of what happened here. Yeah. And like, I'm sorry, like, it's a gorgeous game and it's an amazing soundtrack and there's a lot I like. I was talking with Cam about this a couple weeks ago. It's a game we both, like, I think didn't like at the time, but weirdly also left a huge impression. So maybe secretly I love, you know, maybe I doth protest too much when it comes to Everybody's Gone to the Rapture. But nevertheless, like, I think one of my frustrations was anytime you're doing that sort of mystery box approach to things where it's like, I'm holding information back, there's little gaps here. The implication is the answer is going to be interesting, right? Like, there's going to be an actual mystery here to resolve, right? And I think what comes out in Everybody's Gone to the Rapture is a pretty straightforward, like, chronology of events and, like, relationship status changes. You know, Father Jeremy found faith. It's yeah. I don't know if he really did. Point is. I think that can be double-edged, because I think it can be really interesting to take a story and then remove parts and reshuffle them and tell it a little bit out of order, because then it becomes a puzzle that's satisfying for the player to get into, but it also has to be satisfying.
Yeah, but it also shows you how that person traversed through the space. Like, the fact that they're scattered has a significance. It's not just like, oh, we're going to break up the jigsaw puzzle and throw the pieces everywhere and go find them. It's like, no, this person literally, at least in System Shock and System Shock 2, these people were literally moving throughout these spaces to try and survive and to try, and like their story arcs are specific to the spaces that they move through. And it's funny because at least in Bioshock, correct me if I'm wrong, it's been a gajillion years since I've played it, each audio log, each character only has, like, one audio log found where their body is, right? Or it's like...
Yeah.
It's pretty limited in that sense. Yeah.
So what's so fascinating about System Shock 2, and obviously, like, System Shock 2 did it first.
It did.
It's one character over, like, a long period of time. It's conversations between characters. So you're really getting to know, and these are, you know, space stations, or they're small and contained, and everybody probably, like, it was pretty easy to know everyone, or at least have an idea of everyone. So it makes sense that you're getting to know these characters, like, super intimately, even though you're, you know, this outsider being sent there to figure out what the hell is going on and hopefully not get killed in the process. But yeah, I loved those audio logs in System Shock 2 and in System Shock, the original.
I think BioShock is doing something different. I think it's interesting. It's using the same motif, but I think
they're more like death log. I don't know.
A little.
Go ahead. Sorry.
It depends. It's in some cases absolutely. I just replayed it like a few months ago, so I'm fresh on the BioShock. But yeah, sorry, Rob. Go ahead.
No, but I mean, like, this is just like, you can correct me, but like, I feel like, so System Shock 2 is very chronological. We have detailed, like, sequences, events that play out around each character. God, I love that point about, like, the element of in the System Shock game is like, oh, this person stood right here where I'm standing and
trying to do this. Yeah.
BioShock is interesting because I think it is really trying to do, like, BioShock is much more interested in character and motivation, I think, than System Shock is. System Shock is interested in that stuff. There's a lot of similarities. Their structures, like, directly mirror each other in System Shock 2 and BioShock. But I think BioShock is a little more interested in unpacking the different motivations and inner monologue of the individual characters. And that is what the audio logs are there to do. Like, I think BioShock, you probably can get a pretty detailed chronology if you really, like, fixate on it, but doesn't invite it. Broadly, what BioShock seems to do, at least to me, is, like, there's a before, which is, like, before, like, basically that New Year's party. Like, everything from the founding of Rapture up to New Year's, what is it, 59? 60?
Mm-hmm.
59, I think.
59.
Where it all goes to shit. And then there's during, where, like, things are rapidly entering the spiral of, like, fascism and street warfare and, you know, executions in the streets. And then it cuts off and there's after. And you are after. Like, the during ends with the creation of your character and you being sent on your mission. And you represent after. But the specific, like, chronology of how it all works out, BioShock isn't so interested in that. It's more just, like, what did people bring with them into this world, and what led them to make the choices they made when we moved into the mid-crisis?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And it's also BioShock being obviously a later game and taking so much from System Shock 2 that it basically owes its entire existence to System Shock 2, to your point, Natalie, absolutely. But it's also very interested in, and not subtly, in any way subtly, but it's also very interested in doing a lot of that world building with art assets and lighting and that sort of thing, as much as those sort of the radio play aspect of it. You know, the lighting in Fort Frolic, the way it, like, guides your eye towards certain things, the way that it uses, like, literal casino design and sort of the design of other places and other types of gaming and making you spend money, and how much that says about things like capitalism and how much this is a super libertarian hellscape capitalist society, like things like that. Again, not subtle. It's not a subtle game. There's no subtlety in BioShock at all, but it's doing it effectively, I think. And I am always probably going to be one of those people who's like, actually, BioShock was pretty good. Not subtle, but pretty good.
Second
game too. Second game is kind of great as well, and does those lore bits quite well. Now that we're talking about BioShock, I have to shout out my best friend Prey, aka Psycho Shock, according to Joseph Anderson, and just how well. It's in the same tradition, absolutely, but just how well things like audio logs and emails and other sort of little details in the world tell you so much about that world. I'm going to specifically shout out the Starbender Chronicles, the, like, cheesy ass sci-fi books that are sort of all over the world.
I love those. Prey.
I made sure to, you know, I obviously found everything eventually. And there were more in Mooncrash, which made me very excited.
Oh,
there
I still need to play
There were
Mooncrash.
More Starbender books. Yeah. That's, oh, God.
You gotta do it. I gotta do it. I definitely found good. All the books, too, though. That it was, like, extremely my shit.
Yeah, that's like a piece of fiction where, of course, you could completely play this game and not care about any of that stuff and still really enjoy the game and enjoy the fiction, at least on some level. But that added so much. It just added so much about, you know, various characters and their dorky habits and things. The D&D campaign.
Oh, wonderful. I love it.
Yeah, it just adds so much to the character in the world. It just tells you so much about these people, and it makes them feel like people who lived instead of, in the Bioshock tradition, this really grand, it's kind of broad, almost like screaming from the rafters Broadway interpretation of like characters who lived in a world versus Prey, which I'm not going to call it subtle, but more subtle than that in terms of its characterizations. For sure.
Yeah, I'll say that, like, at least in System Shock 2, the audio logs all were relevant to what went wrong in the space station. Mm-hmm. And in here, in Prey, there is more, I mean, you get characterization through you know, the panic, through the problem solving, through all of that. But in Prey, there is, like, more sort of just building the character without the context, or, like, without the, you know, what went wrong sort of scenario yeah. being at the core of what they're talking about every time. Which is so awesome to just see, like, daily life in the crew quarters, just seeing sort of like daily existence, what it was like to be, you know, just living on the space station, is so awesome. And does so much for each of those characters. And I don't know, it's strange that with Bioshock, you have sort of not like daily life's characterization as much, or I guess, I don't know, it's been a while since I played Bioshock, so you guys can speak to it a little bit more, but you're never going to encounter that person. I don't know, I guess this is a spoiler for Prey, so mute if you don't, but like the idea that like some of the backstory you get and then you like finally like see them and you're like, oh shit, I know you. Yeah. Like, I know about you. I can make informed decisions about my relationship with you, and not just informed decisions like this is the right answer, but informed decisions is like, this is my interpretation of who you are, and I'm going to go off of that, which is just really, really cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think the sort of those narrative breadcrumbs that are scattered around Prey do have to carry a little bit of extra weight, because I don't think Prey leaves into environmental storytelling through environmental design as much as, say, the Dishonored games do. Because, like, it's interesting, like, and it's because they're two very different settings. Like, Prey is a bland corporate space station that was sort of, like, the one bit of, like, environmental detailing there that tells you the history of the place is probably the fact that there's, like, clearly the heart of an old Soviet space station in the middle of the space station. But beyond that, the rest of it's going to be, like, you know, standard office cubes, conference rooms, research labs. What you don't get is, I think, what Arcane leaned a lot on with Dishonored, which is the idea that everything in a Dishonored level is trying to hint at the history and context of the space. Mm. You know, when you go into, like, Dishonored early on introduces you to, like, what the more inhabited, like, what the slums, the inhabited slums of the city look like and what's happening there, and sort of the ways that, like, the plague houses are sort of interwoven with, like, just normal life as people try to carry on. And then you see, like, with, what is it, Lady Boyle's Last Party, how, yep. like, the well-to-do live in these, like, super fortified, gated communities, and it's all, you know, Mask of the Red Death shit in there. It's all just, like, lavish, you know, Fiend the Sequel, you know, partying going on there. And then you go to like places like the Flooded District, and it's a sign of like what this city even was before everything went to hell. And it's sort of a trapped in amber version of like what the city looked like before political upheaval, before like the decline of the empire really started. But of course, it's abandoned now and it's all falling into ruin. And there's a story being told even there. And I think this is another thing that probably, I think that's unusual, and maybe it's something you can only do in a game like Dishonored, where you can have these really discrete locations that exist apart from each other and like can be thematically very, very different, as opposed to prey self-contained. Everything is sort of got to exist on a continuum. So do a lot of open-world games. Open-world games, I think, struggle to portray like transition in a weird, I don't know, because they don't draw attention to it. You don't, open world games, you go to a place and it has a different vibe, but there's no sense of like, these two things were once very similar that diverged. Why? Like, Dishonored is entirely about that. How does a city, how does a country fall apart? That is part of what Dishonored is trying to answer, and so it's concerned with those details. I think a lot of games don't really leverage that aspect of like environmental storytelling. It goes to the we'll show the parents on the bed, you know, with their child's toy, and like that's our environmental storytelling. I don't think you see as much the like the environment itself is telling a story.
The architecture itself, the color design, the you know those kinds of notes. Yeah,
I
agree. Go ahead.
I was only going to say, I wish so much that I liked the way that moving through that game feels, because I'm so interested in the world of Dishonored and Dishonored 2. I like really want to experience that world, but I just cannot jive with the movement and gameplay. I don't know what it is. It's like, it's my biggest sadness,
Some
I think.
Some joyous gamer this outsider. Is.
The sadness gamer has logged on.
Oh, no. Death of the Outsider, I would recommend that to give that a shot, because it's good and a little different. It's a little different. There's some tweaks. Some good tweaks there. One thing that came to mind, Rob, when you were talking about the sort of Dishonored versus Prey thing, is a challenge that I know folks have found some interesting solutions to, but it strikes me as very much a time and place kind of thing, such as Dishonored is set in the 1800s. I know it's not
the, the
on
fake
Earth,
1800s. Yeah,
it's like an 1800s-ish, you know, steampunk-ish. Not all the way steampunk, but a little
pretty
bit.
Pretty steampunk.
An era where people live analog lives, right? All the objects in their world and the architecture in their world is very substantive, right? Versus something like a more digital life in Prey, in a future, you know, where people read books on, you know, it's in their little. All the objects, all books, all that content is on a little screen, just sort of like the way we live our lives, right? And sort of like, okay, people live digital lives in this much more fake-looking environment, in this very bland kind of looking environment. And that, of course, was one of the reasons why they chose the 90s for Gone Home, because that was a time where people live very analog lives and have all these objects that tell stories about people, whereas, you know, unless you design an interface for going into someone's computer or going into their device or whatever it is, it will appear colorless. It will appear anonymous. It'll appear in some ways just an object versus, oh, an object that has, you know, particular meaning no matter what, just looking at it, that sort of thing, which is its own weird and interesting design challenge, I suppose. But yeah, always got to talk about Prey. How could I not? Unless anybody has any other thoughts on lore, I thought maybe we'd take a quick break and go to the question bucket. Any other lore thoughts? I was going to say a thing about Bloodborne and Dark Souls and totally speak for Patrick and Austin, but the brief comment I will make is that those games are very interesting to me for the reasons that, you know, Patrick is not necessarily as interested in lore at all, and he can enjoy those games. And Austin, on the other hand, loves the lore, loves the fact that, you know, the world building is in objects and things that you could ignore, but it's there and it's all sort of the fabric of the game, and it's there for you too. which seems like an interesting and kind of a cool approach. But I'm not going to speak for them. I'm just going to say that one argument that they both have every time we talk about these things, just to represent that they have opinions too, even if they're not here today.
Aww. Miss yeah. you.
We love them. All right, we'll take a really quick break, and then we'll take a brief dip, the briefest dip, into our question bucket.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
All right, I have one question, and it's more of a comment, and it's lore related. So, hear me out. Is anybody here playing Spider-Man, just to be clear? Yeah, Rob's playing Spider-Man. That's right, I should have remembered that. You totally talked about Spider-Man the other day. I'm sorry.
Gotta fix the security cameras of New York. It's my quest. It's my mission.
Ugh.
Just gotta, like,
don't do it.
There's
Rob.
A point where he's like, wow, with these new Oscorp camera sensors, we're getting pings off of every RFID chip for miles. And
Christ.
I was like, good lord.
Bad. Bad spider cop. Bad. Oh, okay. We got a comment here from Alex in Rhode Island. Shout outs to Little Rhodey. Thank you, Alex in Rhode Island. Alex writes, it was mentioned early and often, once the embargo on Spider-Man, Marvel's Spider-Man, lifted, that J. Jonah Jameson was made essentially into an Alex Jones equivalent. One person on the internet said it, before you know it, everyone is saying it, and everyone is very wrong about that. You guys are very outspoken about your politics and fairly well informed about current events, but more so about the cast of characters in our current political theater. I'm surprised that you guys didn't notice it. He wasn't modeled after Alex Jones. He was modeled after Bill O'Reilly. He's always talking about how he's a journalist, like it somehow makes him right, and yelling at his intern about how he's tough but fair. And his show is called Just the Facts, whereas O'Reilly is all about how he covered four wars with a pen from hundreds of miles away, boasts about being fair and balanced, and the most well-known part of his show is the no-spin zone. Jameson kisses Norman Osborn's ass and lobs him softball after softball in one bit of the show, much like O'Reilly would with any conservative who came on his show, and both call those people, the people who disagree with them, quote, idiot, or quote, stupid, and then would cut their mic. Somewhere in these bits, I'm expecting there to be a riff on O'Reilly's Papa Bear nickname, Alex in Rhode Island. How could we get it wrong?
I love the comment bucket.
Send your comments too.
Thanks, Alex.
Do you have a response?
Natalie Watson, 2018. Cool story. No,
this is actually good.
It is good.
It's a good comment.
Like, I think there's a good point here, which is that, like, O'Reilly somehow remained vaguely respectable long after he should have, even though, like, his act, I think one, like, there's a bit of the amnesia that I think afflicts all of us right now, where, especially now where, like, a year seems like 10 years. O'Reilly's been off the air for a little bit. And now he's podcasting or something, right? I don't know. He's paying off harassment suits and, he's podcasting. It's easy to forget him at this point. Like, now,
well,
Alex
when you
Jones,
have Alex Jones, yeah, when you have him just so fucking loud in your face every single fucking morning when you log on Twitter, like, how can you have the bandwidth in your brain to remember all the shit lords of the, you know, I don't know. But, yeah, continue, Rob, sorry.
No, but I think it's a fair point where, like, an Alex Jones version of J. Jonah Jameson is probably a completely different character. Like, J. Jonah Jameson, like, was always an asshole, but, like, he was a tough newspaper editor and kind of a shitty, abusive boss, but, like, ah, damn it, you kind of love the bastard. And for him to become an Alex Jones character is a bit of a reach, but it's very easy for him to, like, curdle into a full Bill O'Reilly character, using the credibility accrued from his journalistic history and perch to launder like toxic ideology and sort of get away with it for a long time. I guess it is a useful distinction, but it is also, I think, we're already in the process of getting who the fuck Bill O'Reilly is. In 10 years, like, he's going to be a fucking footnote. Like, people are going to talk about Alex Jones because, like, he's the logical endpoint. And no one's going to remember fucking Bill O'Reilly or Judge Maria or whoever the whatever fuck her name is. Like, no one's going to give a shit.
So does J. Jonah Jameson not have the bugle in this game, or does he still have that?
No, he's out.
He's out.
Yeah, he's
okay.
not at the bugle anymore.
So that's even
and
the
Jay's
more direct,
somebody
like
else at the bugle.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Yeah. I mean, closer. That makes that. Yeah.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. And it is like weirdly, I thought of because I just listened to this. The Citations Needed. I know we talk about them all the time. I'm sorry, but they did a brief episode on John McCain and his legacy, and just how fondly remembered, you know, McCain was for being, you know, what a guy on human rights. But of course, you know, the truth being awful on human rights, you can't be great on human rights if you're advocating bombing people. And just sort of like, well, because he wasn't as bad as the current guy kind of thing, or he didn't seem as bad in some ways as another horrible.
Yeah,
awful
it's like Grandpa Bush.
Politician. Yeah, exactly.
The
very, very
fuck
similar.
Is happening?
Similar, like, almost whitewashing of, like, oh, the guy who was 99% as bad in many ways. I know I'm oversimplifying this, but, oh, this person who was bad, but, like, maybe not quite as bad. Oh, this guy's worse, so therefore let's sort of, like, throw some love on the guy who wasn't quite as bad in every single way, which is horrifying and toxic and not awesome.
Yeah, it's this infuriating, like, fucking Obama acting like he's pals with Boehner. Like, yeah, okay, right. I guess he is
Come
better
on.
Than what you got in the end, but, like, he was a brick on the road to hell. Like,
it's
deeply frustrating. Political reporters are just the absolute fucking worst. And
not helping us out right
the
now.
The faux objectivity, I think, is not objectivity, but the, it is interesting to me the combination of act like you've been here before, no cheering in the press box, like pretensions of that class with the clear rush they get off of being in the proximity of people like John McCain. Like the fact that clearly it made a huge impression on them that he hung out with them and knew their fucking names and like threw a party and invited them. Like, that mattered a tremendous amount to them. Like, what a decent fucking guy. Like, couldn't be anything but decent if he invited media types over just to hang out. What could possibly be the ulterior motive there? It's like, the Washington Press Corps is the people who get, like, the fucking Christmas turkey from the mob boss and are like, awesome! Hell yeah! I can...
They're doing a lot for the city! You know?
Yeah. But I do, I think the distinction of J. Jonah Jameson being O'Reilly and not Alex Jones, I think it is important because we can't forget about the shitlords of the past.
Correct.
Because they're still here, you know, they're still operating in these spaces, John McCain
and they paved
up
the
until
way.
Yeah, John McCain yeah. up until his death was, you know, had not resigned and was still in office. And President Bush is, you know, still like in political circles, obviously, and Bill O'Reilly has a fucking podcast. You know, like these they don't just disappear. Like they still have power. They still have political power. They still have influence. They still have agency to do things that they want to do and or say things that they want to say and platform the topics and ideologies that they think are important. So it is, you know, it's kind of interesting that you know, to see J. Jonah Jameson and think, like, oh, be reminded of someone in the past, rather than, like, placing someone of now in there, be reminded of someone in the that was maybe more at the forefront of the past, and be like, oh, yeah, he still sucks.
I think there's usefulness in showing how a character like that does transform over time and context, right? Like, yeah, this totally tracks. Like, this is what Jameson would turn into. Like, an angry, bitter asshole on the airwaves. But, and I think you're, like, these people don't go away, and they will always be trading on their vestigial credibility to try to disarm people from recognizing what they're actually doing, even as they do it right in front of you. Like, this flurry of, what happened to Tucker Carlson pieces? Some of which have been good, but, like, a little late to be asking, right? Like, here's the alternate. Nothing happened to Tucker Carlson. Like, Tucker Carlson just found it ever more profitable to, like, reveal himself. But, like, this idea that, oh, you know, he used to work under respectable mastheads. So, ergo, you know, we couldn't have gotten it wrong. Something must have changed. What if it didn't? And what if those mastheads were never that respectable? Just a thought.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I think that's a very good place to end this today. What if those mastheads weren't respectable? This has been Waypoint Radio, of course, and if you have a question or a comment, like Alex's very good and personal comment here,
yes,
you can send questions to gaming@vice.com with the subject question. Shout-outs, as always, to Bowen for letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. We're on Twitter at Waypoint. We're on Facebook at Waypoint Vice. We're on YouTube at Waypoint Vice. Of course, we're on Twitch, twitch.tv/Waypoint, and you can read everything that we write on waypoint.vice.com. Let's go around the room and see where we can find people online. Natalie, where can people find you?
At Natalie Watson on the Twitters.
Awesome. Kato, where can we find you?
At @A_Kato_appears.
Rob, how about you?
At Rob Zachney on twitter.com.
Oh, very nice radio voice there. Very, very nice. I like that. I'm at Danielle R.I. if you care to follow me as well. I wish you all a good weekend. And as always, I say, be good and be good at it.
Peace. That was me being Rob.
You know, if you think about it, my last thought just by Robert Browning is an epic lore dump.
God. Damn it.
Good. So good.
God.
Rob, how do you do that every time? You just always have a thing. Maybe you
prepare. Rob's got the final word.
That's the last
new podcast. Rob's last word.
I love it. I love it. It's so good.
We regret to inform you the final word has become racist. What happened to Rob Zachney?
Record time for the milkshake duck on that one. Right there.
What's wrong with having a monoculture? I don't understand.
Oh no, Rob, come back!
Jesus Christ.
No.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.